Well, I greet you in the name of Jesus, the one that has promised to return, as we heard tonight. It wasn't today yet. Maybe it'll be tomorrow. For our lesson this evening, I would like to look at two unusual plants. Usually we think of animals that kill other animals for food. We talk about the food chain. The faster, the bigger animals kill the smaller animals, and that's the cycle keeps going. But did you know that there are some plants that eat things as well? There are some plants that grow in soil that where the soil does not have enough minerals for food for the plant. For example, there's some plants that grow in some bogs or swamps or wet or sandy beaches where there's not enough minerals there for the plant. And so the roots cannot source the needed nutrients for the plant. And so God figured out how he could have plants in those areas and still have the plant survive. And so these plants get extra minerals by catching and feeding on insects and sometimes even some small mammals that get caught in their trap. And so we're going to look at two unusual plants. The first one I want to look at is called the pitcher plant. Does anyone have a pitcher plant at home? Nobody has one? This is what a pitcher plant looks like. And the research that I did, there are a few different types of pitcher plants. So there's some that look a little bit different than this, but it's more of a tall tubular plant with an open top. So this is an opening here. And down below, down in the bottom of this tube, there's some digestive juices down inside there. Which is that those digestive juices are flesh-dissolving enzymes that dissolve its prey. So you say, well, why would an insect or a small mammal go down in there? What would cause it to go down in there? Well, how it catches the insects is around the lip of the plant, right up around the edge of this opening, there's real little hairs that are angled downward. And when a fly or little insect gets on that, those little hairs, it's almost impossible for him to travel back up. All he can do is go down, and it just directs him down. And so there's a toxic nectar around the edge, which also drugs the insect when it lands on there and is attracted by that nectar. It's a toxic nectar. It drugs it. And then this causes the insect to drop down inside the tube where that liquid is. And on top of that, the walls inside of that tubular plant are very waxy and slippery. So any insect that gets down in there has no way of climbing back up. And so the insect simply drowns in the liquid. And once it drowns, it sinks down to the bottom, where with the rest of the insects in the graveyard, and where the digestive juices begin to eat up and dissolve that insect, and it gets nutrients from that insect. And basically, mostly it's insects that get down in there, but there have been times where even a small mouse or something will, if there's a plant next to a ledge, the mouse will start to be attracted to that nectar, and it'll drop down in there and it can't get back out. It'll actually dissolve a whole mouse if it has the opportunity. Fascinating plant that will eat insects. There's another one called the Venus flytrap plant. Perhaps you have heard of this one. Kind of a monster looking plant. Not the prettiest looking of plants. But the leaves on the plant, it's basically if you would cut a circle and fold it in half, that's sort of what it looks like. But it remains open, and around the edge it has those big ugly teeth that are there, or needles sticking all around the edge. And the inside of that clam-looking leaf is red. And I'll let these pictures lay up here, but you can actually see on this picture here, this is why I like this picture, you can see inside there, you can see little hairs sticking up. And those hairs are triggers. And when an insect lands in there, and as it's walking around in there, if it bumps one of those triggers, that is what triggers the plant to all of a sudden it goes closed like this, and the insect is trapped inside there. So it's like a giant mouth that's open with a trigger inside. When the insect flies inside there, it clamps shut, and then the mouth turns into a stomach. As that closes, that pod inside there begins to fill up with digestive fluids, and it digests the insect or whatever it is that went inside there. So this is what we call carnivorous plants. One question that I thought of is, did God create carnivorous plants to operate that way before the fall? Is that how they operated before the fall? I don't know. You're welcome to give me your opinion afterwards. If he did, there would have been death before the fall. So did God change these plants after the fall to catch insects and small mammals? I don't know. It's just something interesting to think about. Either way, however it happened, in my mind, these plants are just another example of God's amazing creation. And as you see God and he's just unique. And if we had to come up with all these ideas, I don't think we would come up with half of these ideas. But God is just amazing. Let's sing our theme song again. Our God, He is Alive, number 785, the Zion's Praises. This evening we'll sing verse 1 and 2. Verse 1 is, there is beyond the azure blue. Verse 2, there was a long, long time ago. Verse 1.
There is beyond the azure blue a God concealed from human sight. He tinted skies with heavenly hue and framed the world.
Open your Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 17. The title of the message this evening is The Making of a Giant Killer. Probably one of the most popular stories, one of the more popular stories of the Old Testament is the story of David and Goliath. I remember as a boy liking that story, and well, sometimes when I'm trying to decide what to preach on at home, I'll ask my children just for fun. I'll say, "What should I preach on Sunday?" And I can almost count on it. The answer is David and Goliath. Children love the story because there's this big giant that fights against this shepherd boy, and the shepherd boy is victorious. And anytime you have a story that involves a giant, a shepherd boy, bravery, a slingshot, and victory, children are going to like it, right? And maybe us adults like it as well. But I think us, the youth and adults, maybe enjoy this story as well because there's some lessons that we can learn from it. Maybe we can apply it to giants in our life that we face. Because we all face giants in our life sooner or later. And giants come to us in different forms and different times in our life. And the way God miraculously delivered David is an encouragement to each of us. Some people try to discredit this story. Those that do not believe the Bible and do not want to believe in God, they will try to discredit this story. And in my studies, I came across some interesting thoughts that I don't agree with, and I'm not going to take the time to talk about those things tonight. But one thing I did think about as I studied this very familiar story again, I'll talk about it later, but I did change the way I view this story just a little bit, and I'll let you know about that here in a little bit. 1 Samuel chapter 17, let's begin reading. This is a long chapter. It would be interesting to read the whole story, but for sake of time, we're not going to do that. But let's start reading. We know the story well. The Philistines were gathered together, and Saul and his men were gathered together. Start in at verse 3. And the Philistines stood on a mountain on the one side, and Israel stood on a mountain on the other side, and there was a valley between them. So you get this picture here. In my studies, it seems like this valley was probably, the sides of the mountain were probably fairly steep, and there was probably a kind of a narrow valley between these two mountains. And so you have these two mountains with this narrow, steep valley coming down between them, and on the one mountain you have the Philistines, and the other mountain, you have the Israelites, and they're getting ready for battle. Verse 4. And there went out a champion out of the camp of the Philistines named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. And he had a helmet of brass upon his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail. And the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of brass. And he had greaves of brass upon his legs and a target of brass between his shoulders. And the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron, and one bearing a shield went before him. And he stood and cried unto the armies of Israel and said unto them, Why are ye come out to set your battle in array? Am not I a Philistine and ye servants to Saul? Choose you a man for you, and let him come down to me. If he be able to fight with me and to kill me, then will we be your servants. And if I prevail against him and kill him, then ye shall be our servants and serve us. And the Philistine said, I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. When Saul and all Israel heard those words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. We'll stop reading right there. Now, I read a lot of details here that probably don't mean a lot to you, because when I read shekels of brass and a weight of coat, 5,000 shekels of brass and all that, it doesn't mean much to me. So let's try to bring this to life a little bit. First of all, it says that his height was 6 cubits and a span, the last part of verse 4. If a cubit is 18 inches, approximately 18 inches, that would make Goliath around 9.5 foot tall. Now, I was looking, before church started, I was looking at these ceilings. I'm assuming these ceilings are roughly 10 and a half foot. Do you know? Is that right? Somewhere in there. Between 10 and 10.5 foot would be my guess. So that means if Goliath would walk in the door, first of all, he'd have to stoop pretty far to get through that door. And when he stood up, he would be within 6 to 12 inches of the ceiling. Okay? So just picture that. Be a rather tall man. Some of you children, if you would stand in front of them, you would feel pretty small. It said that he had a helmet of brass on his head and a coat of mail. Well, what does that mean? The coat of mail was literally plates of brass. From the studies that I did, more than likely it was plates of brass that overlapped each other so that he could move and slide, sort of like the scales of a fish. If you ever look at scales in a fish, they kind of the half circle that overlap each other. It's a little bit what this was, except it was made of brass, and he had this over himself. It says this coat of mail weighed 5,000 shekels. Well, if I did my calculations right, that coat alone weighed 125 pounds approximately. That's more than most of you children here, and well, I won't say anything more about weight. But 125 pounds, it's heavy enough. It says he had greaves of brass upon his legs. Basically, this was like metal shin guards. You enjoy playing hockey, you put plastic shin guards on. This would have been heavy metal shin guards with probably leather straps that held them in place. Then it says he had a target of brass between his shoulders. And this was a brass plate that hung between his shoulders and the back to protect the vulnerable spot in his back between his shoulder blades. So with all his size, plus his armor, picture a man almost as, 6 inches or 12 inches shorter than this ceiling, plus that 125-pound coat, plus the metal shin guards and that brass plate hanging in the back, you can imagine how intimidating this man looked and this helmet that he had on. His weapons were equally impressive. It says the staff of his spear was as a weaver's beam. So again, I did some research. What's a weaver's beam? How big are they typically? Well, a weaver's beam was the wooden frame used to hold the thread that they used to weave and make cloth. And so they varied in size, so we don't know exactly how large it was, but it is thought that the thickness of this beam was 2 or 2.5 inches in diameter, so it's a good heavy-duty beam. The spear at the end, the spearhead, it says weighed 600 shekels of iron. That's approximately 15 pounds, so just the head of this spear was 15 pounds. So this was no small spear. Just for comparison, according to my research, the standard spearhead in those days were 8 to 12 inches long and weighed 1 pound. This weighed 15 pounds. So quite a bit heavier, especially in comparison to the Israelite soldiers. As they saw this man come out and defy their God with this big spear, they probably looked at their little spears and said, "Say kind of work. I'm going to turn and go the other way." On top of that, it says Goliath had a man with a shield going out in front of him. So not only was it this big giant with all this armor and this spear, he also had a man in front of him to protect him. And so when Goliath and his guard with the shield stepped out, it's no wonder the Israelites ran away and turned around and left and said, "I'm not going to fight this giant." This was an extremely intimidating situation for them. The total weight of this man, and the Bible doesn't tell us what this man weighed in at without his armor. But if you do some calculations, and I don't know if you are familiar with the BMI ratings that you put in your height and age and all, I forget what all you put in, and it tells you if you're obese or not, or, if we use that, according to current BMI ratings, at 9.5 foot tall, he would have been healthy and trim at 450 pounds. So I'm guessing he could have easily weighed 550 pounds plus all his armor. So with all the coat of mail, the helmet, the spear, this man walked out there could have been easily 800 plus pounds. And so this big, intimidating giant comes out. And on top of that, he's not real friendly. And he defies God. Now, I don't know if you've ever been around someone that defied God. I don't know if you've ever been around a normal-sized person that defies God. But it's not a relaxing situation, I'll say that. It doesn't make you feel real easy, much less when he's that big, when he's a giant. For 40 days, this giant came out, morning and evening, and defied God and said, "Send someone to come and fight me. Come on down and fight me." 40 days. Now, I don't know what you were doing 40 days ago, but 40 days was September 29. Can you imagine every morning and every evening since September 29th till today, this giant came out. These two armies were there on these mountains. And then David the shepherd boy comes along and he defeats this giant with a slingshot and a stone. Isn't that an amazing story? We didn't even get into it yet. It's an exciting story, and there's a lot we can learn. God rewarded David with a great victory that day. So what can we learn from this intriguing story? Well, there's a few things, and I didn't necessarily say that this sermon is for the youth, but in a sense, it is geared towards the youth, but it's for all of us as well. Number one, God prepares his servants. David grew up as a shepherd boy by the hand of God, and I believe that God was preparing him for something great. And when Samuel is sent to anoint the next king of Israel, the older brothers are all at the feast. We know the story. The older brothers are there at the feast, and Samuel goes down through from the oldest to the youngest, and God says, "Nope, it's not him. Finally, Samuel says, "Well, don't you have another son?" He said, "Well, yeah, David's out, you know, watching the sheep." "Well, bring him here." And David was the man. David was the boy. First of all, something I want us to observe is that it seems like David accepted his lot in life. When you read that story of Samuel coming, I don't know if David knew that Samuel was coming, that they were having a special visitor. But it seems like he accepted his lot in life. "I'm a shepherd boy. I'm the youngest. This is my job, and I'm going to do it well." And I believe that David did the best that he could do as a shepherd boy. He obviously took his job seriously, because when a bear came after the sheep, he didn't run. He went after the bear. When a lion came after the sheep, he didn't run. He took care of the lion. And so he took his job seriously. And that tells me something about David, that he accepted his lot in life and he put his all into whatever he was doing. Secondly, as a shepherd boy, as part of this, God preparing his servants, not only did he accept his lot in life, but he got practice with a sling. He was getting practice as a sling. Possibly, this gave him time out in the pasture to practice his shot with his sling. And he had the opportunity to put his skills to practice while under pressure with the bear and the lion. It's one thing to go out there and target practice with your bow. It's another thing when that big buck comes by and you get the shakes, right? And you're nervous. And at least I would assume. I never shot a bow at a buck, or at any deer for that matter. But there's a difference between when the pressure is on, it makes a difference. And David had the opportunity to do that. Do you believe that God directs the minute details of your life to prepare you? Do you believe that tonight? I believe he does. I believe that God prepares his servants. God's hand moves and directs in our lives. And especially young people, I think sometimes you might feel like, "Well, I'm just a shepherd boy. I'm just a nobody here. I'm not doing anything great. I'm just a school teacher. I'm just a parts guy. I'm just a, I don't know, whatever you want to put in there. I'm nothing great. I wish I could do more. All I have to do is this boring job of watching the sheep. And how much talent does that take? I have a lot more potential in life than this." And I think young people can get restless sometimes. You feel like you're in a rut. And you wish you could get out and fight some giants sometimes, maybe. You feel like you want to do something great. You have enthusiasm, and you have vision, you have excitement. And you want to do more than just come to Ridgeview every Sunday morning and go to work Monday through Friday or Saturday, and then come to Ridgeview again on Sunday morning. There's more to life than that, right? Maybe you wish that someday you could be the captain of the army like David became, or even become king as David did. And you wish that you could make a larger impact in life. Well, just remember, just as God prepared and led David through life, he wants to do the same thing for you. And what does God look for when he needs a captain of the army? What does he look for? What does God look for when he needs a king of Israel? What is it that he looks for? Well, he looks for the servants that are faithful where they are, just like David was. David was out there taking his sheep out through the desert, doing what a faithful shepherd should be doing. And it's then that God came and called him for something greater. But even after he called David for something greater, it went a long time till it actually came to fruition. Even after he killed the giant, when he knew that he was going to be the next king, and Saul was after him, he had the opportunity to get rid of Saul in that cave. And he could have taken it into his own hand, and he could have been king right then. But he just waited. He left God set up his authority. And what's interesting, as a boy, when David was growing up, and he allowed God to set him in position and put him in position. And then later on in life, when David's own boys came up, and Absalom came and overtook the throne, you know what David did? He fought for it, right? No. He said, if God gave it to me, God can keep it in my hands if that's what he wants. And he left. He said, I'm not going to fight my son. I'm not going to fight Absalom. He allowed God to work it out. You see, the reason that David was even here, the reason he even showed up here in 1 Samuel 17 in the first place, is because he was just a messenger. His dad sent him and said, go take some bread to your brothers and see how things are going. And he was faithful in doing the small things, and then he was used of God to do something great, like slaying a giant. So young people especially, and all of us, faithfully do what God is calling you to do right now. Do it faithful. Do it with all your might. Practice your slingshot, even if it's hitting trees. Someday a bear might come out. Someday there might be a giant, and you can use that. But do your best. Number two, another lesson that I think we can learn is that we must recognize giants in our lives for what they are. It is not good for us to either minimize the giants or to run from the giants. You see, whenever we become self-confident, taking things into our own hands, that's when things generally go downhill. That's when we fail, when we try to take things into our own hands. Saul did this when he offered to sacrifice instead of waiting on Samuel. You remember that story? He was supposed to wait for Samuel to come to offer the sacrifice, but Samuel wasn't showing up, and so Saul said, well, I'll just do it myself. And it got him in trouble. And when we think that we can handle things on our own, we quickly move ahead of God. Let's be like David and let God set us up, set up our authority, set up whatever it is. Let him work the details rather than trying to force God into the details. God wants us to recognize the giants and look to him for deliverance. Giants weren't anything new to the Israelites. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 7. You can keep your finger here in 1 Samuel. We'll come back to it. Deuteronomy chapter 7. And verse 17, if thou shalt say in thine heart, these nations are more than I, how can I dispossess them? Thou shalt not be afraid of them, but shalt well remember what the Lord thy God did unto Pharaoh and unto all Egypt, the great temptations which thine eyes saw, and the signs and the wonders, and the mighty hand and the stretched out arm, whereby the Lord thy God brought thee out. So shalt the Lord thy God do unto all the people of whom thou art afraid. Moreover, the Lord thy God will send the hornet among them until they are left, and hide themselves from thee, be destroyed. Thou shalt not be affrighted at them, for the Lord thy God is among you, a mighty God and terrible. And the Lord thy God will put out those nations before thee by little and little. Thou mayest not consume them at once, lest the beasts of the field increase upon thee. But the Lord thy God shall deliver them unto thee, and shall destroy them with a mighty destruction until they be destroyed. And he shall deliver their kings into thine hand, and thou shalt destroy their name from under heaven. There shall no man be able to stand before thee until thou have destroyed them. God is telling them, here's how it's going to work. Little by little, we're going to destroy the enemy. We'll do it together. Don't move ahead. Don't do it all at one time. You just follow my lead. And we're going to do this together. God also told them to fear not in facing the giants of Anak. If you go to Deuteronomy chapter 9, the first three verses, he says, hear, O Israel, thou art to pass over Jordan this day to go into possess nations greater and mightier than thyself, cities great and fenced up to heaven. Now, isn't that an encouragement? Say, you're going to face people that are bigger than you, they're more powerful than you, and they have, it's cities that are fenced up to heaven. And people great and tall, the children of the Anakims, whom thou knowest, and of whom thou hast heard say, who can stand before the children of Anak? Understand, therefore, this day that the Lord thy God is he which goeth over before thee as a consuming fire. He shall destroy them, and he shall bring them down before thy face. So shalt thou drive them out and destroy them quickly, as the Lord hath said unto thee. And so in the same conversation, God is saying, you're going to face giants. You're going to face giants that are mightier than you, that are bigger than you, and you can't handle them. But don't worry, I'm going to go before you as a consuming fire and destroy them for you. If you're facing something in life that looks too big for you, it probably is. Sometimes we use the phrase, God won't give you more than you can handle. It's on, you see that everywhere. It's on, maybe some of you have it hanging on your wall. If you do, you should take it down, maybe. Because it's not true. God gives us things that we can't handle. But he will never give you things bigger than what he can't handle. It was actually, some time ago, I preached through a whole series of phrases like that that are not actually true. But anyway, that's another subject for a different time. God will give you giants that you can't handle, just like the children of Israel here. He told them, these giants are bigger than you and you can't handle them. And brothers and sisters, if we go through life thinking that we have to handle all the giants ourselves, we're going to fail. We have to understand, we have to recognize giants for what they are. David was able to face the giant because he looked to God. If we go back to 1 Samuel 17, to our text here, in verse 32, and we know the story well, so I'm not going to read the verses in between here, I don't believe. In verse 32, he says, and David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail because of him. Thy servant will go and fight with this Philistine. Jump down to verse 45. Then said David to the Philistine, thou comest to me with a sword and with a spear and with a shield, but I come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defied. This day will the Lord deliver thee into mine hand, and I will smite thee and take thine head from thee, and I will give the carcass of the host of the Philistines this day unto the fowls of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. And all this assembly shall know that the Lord saveth not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. That is confidence. David saw the giant for what he was, but he also saw God for who he was. And he knew that his God was bigger than the giant in front of him. And he said, together, we can face that giant. And we also can face the giants today if we are willing to look to God for strength and if we have the faith that David had. And we're willing to run into the face of that giant and say, my God is bigger than that giant. Number three, we must be ready and willing to exercise our gifts and talents for the kingdom of God. And here's where, as I studied and thought about this story, I looked at it just a little bit different. I always looked at Goliath as the seasoned warrior and David as sort of the underdog. And in a sense, that is how it was. Certainly, David didn't have the military experience that Goliath had. But as I studied ancient warfare, I understood that there were different types of warriors in ancient warfare, just like there are today, and that makes sense. I just had never thought about that before, I guess. Goliath would have been considered part of the infantry. The infantry practice hand-to-hand combat, and that's what Goliath was used to, on foot, hand-to-hand. That's why he had that big spear, and that was an advantage. If you take a big man with a big, long spear against a small man with a little spear, the big man has an advantage, right? And that's why he would have been armored so heavily, because of that hand-to-hand combat. And had David wore Saul's armor like Saul wanted him to do and fought Goliath hand-to-hand, he probably wouldn't have had a chance, other than if God would have worked a miracle just like he did. I understand that. But I think David understood that he was not used to this type of combat. In verse 39, he says that. And David girded his sword upon his armor, and he essayed to go, for he had not proved it. And David said unto Saul, I cannot go with these, for I have not proved them. And David took them off. So after Saul put all his armor and got his sword, David put it on and he said, wait a minute, this is not going to work. I am not used to this type of fighting. David would have been considered a slinger. And from what I understand, slings, similar to what David would have used, were actually used in ancient warfare. And a specialized slinger in ancient warfare would have been similar to what snipers are today. If you understand what a sniper is and what they do, they're not used to that combat that's more specialized forces. And according to my studies, bullets from the sling could go as far as 430 yards and possibly travel at 150 foot per second. And David possibly honed this skill as a slinger while watching the sheep, like we talked about earlier. David knew his strengths and he knew his weaknesses. He knew that his strength was in being a sniper, not in hand-to-hand combat. And he knew that he wouldn't have a chance with Saul's armor, but he knew if he took some stones and his slingshot, he had a really good chance at defeating this Goliath, this giant. But we have to balance out using our talents for God and relying on God for our strength. Because today, the most skilled slinger struggles to get enough velocity along with the accuracy to penetrate a skull. It was it's fascinating to study that. You should study it if you have an opportunity. But today, men will try to practice that and get enough velocity that it would actually penetrate a skull and kill a Goliath like this. And they can maybe do that, but their accuracy is way down. And if they try to get it accurate, they can't get enough velocity. And so therefore, David's task of getting enough velocity and hitting at just the right spot with all that, between all that armor, was extremely difficult. And I think David knew that. And that is why we need to balance out giving our all and yet relying on God. You see, sitting back and doing nothing like David's brothers and the rest of the soldiers did was not right. It was not the right answer. Forging ahead on your own strength. If David would have forged ahead on his own strength and say, ha, I killed a bear and I killed a lion and I can kill this giant as well, it probably wouldn't have worked out so good if he would have went on his own. But he brought these two things together where he used his talent and the skill that he had along with the strength of God, and he fought that giant and he won. Number four, the fourth lesson that we can learn is that past victories strengthen our faith in God. I don't know how David was feeling when he walked out there and started walking down that valley, down the mountain into the valley. I don't know if his heart was pumping. I'm guessing it probably was beating pretty fast, faster than normal. But when David faced this terrific task, he looked back to previous victories that God helped him with to give him, to boost his faith in what he can do in the future. David had faith that God would again deliver him from this giant. In verse 37, David said, moreover, the Lord that delivered me out of the paw of the lion and out of the paw of the bear, he will deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine. He went back and he said, that lion and that bear, God delivered me from them. And if God delivered me from them, from those two things, he can deliver me from this giant as well. And he ran toward that giant, confident that God would deliver the giant to him. We read that verse in verse 46, where he ran towards that giant and said, God is going to deliver you to me today. We do good to reflect on the times that God has delivered us, what God has done for us. And it is good for us to think and reflect on those things. When we face giants, when we face hardships, when we face temptations, whatever that giant is in your life, and it looks big to us, think back of all the things that God did for you. And say, if God brought me this far, I can take care of this giant as well with God's help. Number five, and last of all, we must always stand for and defend the name of the Lord. I can imagine that probably any good slinger, I don't like to fill my mind with a lot of warfare stories, but I have listened to a few stories of a sniper, and it gets in their blood that they just want to go out there and, like, it's I don't know how to explain it, but they want to go do it. It gets them excited. That's what they're there for. And probably any good slinger would have almost enjoyed the challenge of facing Goliath. I can imagine. There's probably a good slinger would almost, from a skilled combat perspective, you could see the advantages of a slinger. You would say, okay, well, here's his weakness, and this is my strength, and I think my strength, and you put that battle plan together, and you say, I can do this. But I don't believe that's what fueled David. That's not what got David excited. That's not why he said, I'm going to go fight this giant. It wasn't because he saw his advantages and Goliath's disadvantages. What fueled David's desire to defeat Goliath was the fact that Goliath defied his God and denied. I can't think of the word. But he was ready to go and challenge this giant because of what he was doing and because of what he was saying. And he was sticking up for his God, defying. That's the word I wanted. Goliath was defying his God. And that is what fueled David. David refers to this several times. Look at verse 26, the last part of verse 26. What shall be done to this man who killeth this Philistine and taketh away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? Who does he think he is that he can defy this God? Verse 29. Is there not a cause? There's reason to go out and fight this. Don't just stand here. Go out and fight this giant because he's defying God. Verse 36, the last part of verse 36. Seeing he hath defied the armies of the living God over and over and over again, David is saying, somebody needs to go fight this giant because he's defying God, the living God. David even made it clear to Goliath when he was running out to Goliath, saying, you defied my God, you defied our God, and my God's going to take care of you. And this was a cause to fight for, and David knew it. There are different ways that people defy God today. Defy means openly resist or refuse to obey. It could be in their actions, the way they live their lives. It could be in their speech, openly refusing to believe in God. And we see people around us that defy God today. There are around us. The question is, what is my response? What is your response when you're around someone that defies God or uses the name of the Lord in vain? What is your response? Are you like all the other Israelites that turn and sink back into the mountain? Or are you like David and say, is there not a cause? I need to go stand up for my God. Because my God is more powerful than this man or this woman that looks to be intimidating. Are we a coward like Saul and his army? Or do we look past our fears and say, is there not a cause? We must always stand for and defend the name of the Lord. Well, God wants us to be modern day Davids. Do your best and hone your skills wherever God has you today. He just might be preparing you for something bigger. You might be the king of Israel, not literally, but God might have something big for you planned for you someday. I don't know. But even if he doesn't, be faithful in where you are and hone your skills. Do that the best you can. Recognize the giants in your life for what they are and look to God for victory over them. Be ready to do your part to fight the giant, exercising your talents while relying on God. Reflect on your past victories with God's help to give you courage for the next victory. And be ready to stand up and defend the name of the Lord. The Lord bless you. I don't know what giants you have in your life. But God wants to raise up giant killers. He wants you to be a giant killer, not on your own strength, but to rely on Him. Let's stand for closing prayer.